Chapter 13. Grandeur of France and the perfidiousness of England, and looked at the illuminated picture of Madame Wharton as Ariadne till bedtime. But before he slept, he finished his letter, you may be sure, and called it his custom prestunes of Anglitter. Mind and wake me early, he said to Boots, the one British subject in the Yodel Delale, and who therefore didn't understand him. Wish to be at Smithfield at 6 hours, to see the men sell their wives. And the young rogue fell asleep, thinking what sort of a one he'd buy. This was the way Jules passed his days, and got information about England and the English walking round and round Leicester Square all day, and every day with the same company, occasionally duosified by an opera chorus singer or a Jew or two, and every afternoon in the quadrant admiring the genteel society there. Monsieur Jules was not over well furnished with pocket money, and so his pleasure was of the gratis sort she fly. Well, one day as he and a friend was taking their turn among the aristocracy under the quadrant, they were struck all of a heap by seeing, but, stop, who was Jules' friend? Here you have pictures of both, but the history of Jules' friend must be kept for another innings. 2. Not far from that noble and cheerfully square which Monsieur Jules de Chacabac had selected for his abode in London, not far, I say, from Leicester Square, is a range of buildings called Pipping's Buildings, leading to Blue Lion Court, leading to St. Martin's Lane. You know Pipping's Buildings by its greatest ornament, an almond beef house where Jules has often stood admiring the dexterity of the carver a-cutting the various gins, and by the little fishmongers, where you remark the moldy lobsters, the fly-blown pickless salmon, the playbills, and the gingy bear bottles in the window above all, by the Constantinople divan, kept by the Mrs. Mordecai, and well known to every lover of prime cigar, and an excellent cup of real mochi coffee for 60. The Constantinople divan is greatly used by the foreign gents of Leicester Square. I never had the good fortune to pass down Pipping's Buildings without seeing a half a dozen of them on the threshold of the establishment, giving the street an opportunity of testing the odor of the Mrs. Mordecai's prime Havanas. Two or three more may be visible inside, sitting on the counter or the chestis, indulging in their favorite weed, the rich and spicy Pickwick, the ripe Manly, or the flagrant and aromatic Pie. These divans are, as is very well known, the nightly resort of the young English nobility. It is here a young peer, after an arduous day at the House of Commons, solaces himself with a glass of gin and water, the national beverage, with cheerful conversation on the events of the day, or with an armless game of bagatelle in the back parlor. So wrote at least our friend Jules to his newspaper, the Horiflam. And of this back parlor and bagatelle board, of this counter, of this Constantinople divan, he became almost as regular a frequenter as the plaster of Parish Turku sits smoking a hooky between the two blue coffee cups in the winder. I have often, smoking my own shroud in silence in a corner of the divan, listened to Jules and his friends in weighing against England, and boasting of their own immortal country. How they did go on about Wellington, and what an arty contempt they had for him. How they used to prove that France was the light, the center point, the example and admiration of the whole world. And though I scarcely take a French paper nowadays, I lived in early days as groom in a French family 3 years, and therefore knows the language, though, I say, you can't take up Jules' paper, the Oriflamme, without reading that a minister has committed bribery and perjury, or that a literary man has committed perjury and murder, or that a duke has stabbed his wife in 50 places, or some story equally horrible. Yet for all that it's admirable, to see how the French gents will swagger, how they will be the centers of civilization, how they will be the examples of Europe, and nothing shall prevent them knowing they will have it, I say I listen, smoking my pip in silence. But to our tale. Regular every evening there came to the Constantinople a young gent entered in the ixth of fashion, and indeed presenting by the cleanliness of his appearance, and linen which was generally a pink or blue shirt, with a cricketer or a dancer's pattern, rather a contrast to the dingy and whisk-cart society of the Duan. As for whiskers, this young man had none beyond a little yellow tuft to his chin, which you would notice, only he was always pulling at it. His stature was diminutive, but his costume superb, for he had the tippiest jane boots, the ivory-headest canes, the most gorgeous scarlet Johnville ties, and the most Scotch plaidest trousers of any customer of that establishment. He was unofficially called Millard. K.S.C. June Sagner? Who is this young earl who comes nightly to the Constantinople, apostrophe who is so prodigal of his gold, for indeed the young gent would frequently prop his gin and water to the company, and who drinks so much gin? Ask Monsieur Chacabac of a friend from the Hotel de Lille. His name is Lord Yardham, answered that friend. He never comes here but at night, and why? Why, exclaimed Jules, astonished. Why? Because he is engaged all day, and do you know where he is engaged all day? Where? Asked Jules. At the Foreign Office now, do you begin to understand? Jules trembled. He speaks of his uncle, the head of that office. Who is the head of that office? Palmerston. The nephew of Palmerston, said Jules, almost in a fit. Lord Yardham pretends not to speak French, the other went on. He pretends he can only say oui, and comment portez-vous? Shallow humbug. I have marked him during our conversations. When we have spoken of the glory of France among the nations, I have seen his eye kindle, and his perfidious lip curl with rage. When they have discussed before him the imprudence, the affairs of Europe, and Dragobrichevich has shown us the next Circassian campaign, or Sapison has laid bare the plan of the Calabrian patriots for the next insurrection, I have marked this stranger, this Lord Yardham. He smokes, 'tis to conceal his countenance. He drinks gin, 'tis to hide his face in the goblet. And be sure, he carries every word of our conversation to the perfidious Palmerston, his uncle. I will beard him in his den, thought Jules. Will meet him core a core, the tyrant of Europe shall suffer through his nephew, and I will shoot him as dead as Dujarier. When Lord Yardham came to the Constantinople that night, Jules eyed him savagely from head to foot, while Lord Yardham replied the same. It wasn't much for either to do neither, being more than 4'10". Jules was a granader in his company of the National Guard, and was as brave as a lion. Ah, Langlader, Langlader, tu nous dois une revanche, said Jules, crossing his arms and grinding his teeth at Lord Yardham. Oui, said Lord Yardham, oui. Delenda est Carthago, howled out Jules. Oh, oui, said the Earl of Yardham, and at the same moment his glass of Gina water coming in, he took a drink, saying, Avadern Santi, Monsieur. And then he offered it like a man of fashion to Jules. A light broke on Jules' mind as he accepted the refreshment. Sapas, he said, instead of slaughtering this nephew of the infamous Palmerston, I extract his secrets from him. Suppose I pump him, suppose I unveil his schemes, and send them to my paper? La France may hear the name of Jules de Chacabac, and the star of honor may glitter on my bosom. So, accepting Lord Yardham's courtesy, he returned it by ordering another glass of gin at his own expense, and they both drank it on the counter, where Jules talked of the affairs of Europe all night. To everything he said, the Earl of Yardham answered, oui, oui, except at the end of the evening, when he squeeched his hand and said, bonsoir. There's nothing like going amongst them to inquire the real pronunciation, his lordship said, as he let himself into his lodgings with his latchkey. Hat was a very eloquent young gent at the Constantinople, apostrophe, and I'll patronize him. Ah, perfide, G.T. de Masquerai, Jules remarked to himself as he went to bed in his Hotel de Lille. And they met the next night, and from that evening the young men were continually together. Well, one day, as they were walking in the quadrant, Jules talking, and Lord Yardham saying, we, they were struck all of a heap by seeing, but my paper is interested, and I must describe what they saw in the next number. 3. The castle of the island of Fogo. The traveler who pursues his delightful course through the fair realm of France as a great romantic landscapist and namesake of mind would say, never charmed his eyes within a sight more lovely, or viewed a palace more magnificent than that which was the birthplace of the heroine of this true tale. Fancy a country through whose verdant plains the silvery Garonne winds, like a benevolent serpent. In its placid Busamantine castles, picturesque villages, and waving woods are reflected. Purple hills, crowned with antique ruins, rivulets babbling through gentle green woods, white farmhouses, heavy with hover-hinging vines, and from which the happy and peaceful occupier can cast his glance over golden waving cornfields, and emerald meadows in which the lazy cattle are grazing, while the shepherd, tending his snowy flocks, whiles away the leisure moments on his lute these offer, but a faint picture of the rural felicity in the midst of which crinoline and hysteria de Vidalers were born. Their par, the Marquis de Vidalers, chevalier of the Legend of Honor, and of the Lion of Bulgham, the Golden Fleece, Grand Cross of the Eiffelin and Castle, and of the Catin Bagpipes of Austria, Grand Chamberlain of the Crowned, and Major General of Haus Marines, and C is the 24th or 5th Marquis, that has borne the title, is descended lineally from King Pippin, and has almost as antient a pedigree as any which the Aliwell Street friends of the member of Buckinghamshire can supply. His Marchioness, the lovely and accomplished Emily de St. Cornichon, quitted this martial sphere very soon after as he had presented her lord with the two little darling cherubins above described, in Wam, after the loss of that angle his wife, the disconsolate widower found his only joy on youth. In all his amusements they accompanied him, their education was his sole business. He achieved it with the assistance of the ugliest and most learned masters, and the most hideous and exemplary governesses which money could procure. Or, how must his paternal art have bent, as these buds, which he had nourished, bust into beauty, and twined in blooming fragrance round his parental bosom. The villages all round his ancestral halls blessed the Marquis and his lovely offspring. Not one village in their neighborhood, but was eddened by their elegant beneficence, and where the inhabitants weren't rendered happy. It was a pattern pheasantry. All the old men in the district were virtuous and talkative, had red stockings and high-heeled drab shoes, and beautiful snowy hair. All the old women had peaked hats, and crooked canes, and chintz gowns tucked into the pockets of their quilted petticoats. They sat in picturesque porches, pretending to spin, while the lads and lasses of the villages danced under the elms. Oh, 'tis a noble sight to witness that of an happy pheasantry. Not one of those rustic wassails of the House of Widdlers, but had his hair curled and his shirt sheaves tied up with pink ribbing as he led to the Macy dance some happy country gal, with a black velvet bodice and a red yaller petticoat, a hormillu cross on her neck, and a silver arrow in her hair. When the Marquis and 3 young ladies came to the village, it would have done the eyes of the philanthropist good to see how all received them. The little children scattered calico flowers on their path, the snowy-haired old men with red faces and wrinkles took off their brown paper hats to salute the noble Marquis. Young and old led them to a wooden bank painted to look like a bower of roses, and when they were set down danced ballets before them. Oh, 'twas a noble sight to see the Marquis too, smilin' elegant with feathers, in his head and all his stars on, and the young marchionesses with their plumes, and trains, and little coronets. They lived in tremendous splendor at home in their paternal halls, and had no end of polices, willers, and town and country residences, but their favorite residence was called the Castle of the Island of Fogo. Had I the pen of the author of A Kidlingsby himself, I couldn't describe the gorgeousness of their abode. They had 24 footmen in livery, besides a boy in corduroys for the knives and shoes. they had 9 meals a day. Champagne and pineapples were served to each of the young ladies in bed before they got up. Was it prawns, sherry cobblers, lobster salads, or maids of honor? They had but to ring the bell and call for what they chose. They had 2 new dresses every day, one to ride out in the open carriage, and another to appear in the gardens of the castle of the island of Fogo, which were illuminated every night like Vauxhall. The young noblemen of France were there ready to dance with them, and festive suppers concluded the joyous night. Thus they lived in elegant raiment until misfortune bust upon this happy family. Edich to his princes and abominating the odious Louis-Philippe, the Marquis was conspiring for the benefit of the elder branch of the Bourbons, and what was the consequence? One night a fleet presented itself round the castle of the island of Fogo, and skewering only a couple of chests of jewels, the Marquis and the 2 young ladies in disguise fled from that island of bliss. And whither fled they? To England. England, the home of the brave, the refuge of the world, where the poor slave never sets his foot, but he is free. Such was the romantic tale which was told to 2 friends of ours by the Marquis de Vidalers himself, whose daughters, walking with their page from Ungerford Market, where they had been to purchase a paper of shrimps for the humble supper of their noble father, Yardham and his equines, Monsieur Jules, had remarked and admired. But how had those 2 young arrows become equated with the noble Marquis? That is a mystery we must elucidate in a future volume. The Stars and Stripes. The author, the last of the Mulligans, pilot, etc. I. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.